So about now, I start noticing how much I boss myself around and ignore the instructions I'm getting almost all the time. They're much wiser than I am. I just kind of override them. And when I've been sitting long enough, I begin to remember, because it's louder now, who's making the real decisions in this place? How do we take credit for what really isn't ours? Everything is all about me, mine, I, me, mine. It's my life, it's my mind. I'm directing my life in the way I think it should be going. But the truth is that it's not that way. And it's always so wonderful to remember that the wisdom that we talk about is inherent. It's inherent in everything. You can see it just by looking into the forest, that wisdom is operating there as life, as knowing how to do life and be life. And we ourselves have that ability also, that is what we are. As we said yesterday, our being is our activity. How do we enact life itself? How do we enact ourselves as a baby? We don't figure out how to be a baby. We just wiggle our toes and chew on our fingers. And although as we grow up, and you may remember, I remember resisting being a grown-up. I sure didn't want to be leaving childhood ever. I thought I wouldn't do it. They can't make me. And somehow, it happened anyway. And the more I allowed the happening of this force, you could say, the easier life became. And the more I resisted it, the more difficult it became, really challenging sometimes. You can't make me do this. I've often started sitting zazen thinking that, oh, you can't make me do this all over again, can you? And of course, I'm already here and I'm already doing it and doing it with joy. But there is a bossy person in us who wants to run the show. And it's very helpful to become friends with that one and to recognize and acknowledge it as being a feeble representation of our life. That our life itself is much more powerful and deep than anything we can pretend to be able to orchestrate or direct. So in sitting zazen, we begin to experience pretty early on that we can't make something happen. We're pretty sure we know why we're here and what we think we're doing and what we want to accomplish. But the more we think we know that, and the more we try to do it, the harder it becomes. The more pain we feel, and the less likely are we to have achieved anything except more problem. Because it's not up to us. We don't like to think about that so much. But if you remember any kind of really difficult situation in your life, there are times when we have to just lift up our hands and say, I can't deal with this. Something, help me. And often, if we get to that place, something does. We don't exactly know what that is. The more we try to pin it down and name it, the more confused we become. But the attitude itself is something that we can cultivate in our life altogether. And believe it or not, that's exactly what the Heart Sutra is telling us. Strange, isn't it? It's got all these things with a no in front of it. I often think it's like a big blackboard with all the teachings on it, all the wisdom that Buddha ever gave us about our suffering and how to deal with it. And it says no to all of those. It says, actually, there is no attainment. We don't believe it. When we chant it in the morning, we don't believe it. We like to think, well, yeah, of course there's no attainment, but we just do that. There is no attainment. With nothing to attain. Nothing to attain. This is a very sad thing to say, in a way, because we want so much. We want so much for ourselves. And it's saying there is nothing that we can get. This is what Koban meant when he said to us, every step of our way is a stepping down. The more we realize this, the more humble and the more insightful we become. The Bodhisattva depends on Prajnaparamita. So that's sort of pinning it down, but then what exactly is Prajnaparamita? The mother of all Buddhas. That's an original way of thinking of it. It is the what carries us across to the other shore. That's the gate. Depending on that, another word for it is wisdom. In the Western world, it's Sophia. All through history, human history, there has been this identification of wisdom with some sort of natural feminine force. that grows the grass. And carries us. But it goes on in the sutra to say, realizing this, our mind is no hindrance. And this brings us back to Zazen again. Because as we sit, our mind is carrying on like a fire. It's just going and going and going. And often we get exasperated with it and want it to stop and try to stop it and become annoyed with it or embarrassed by it or every kind of feeling you can find you will feel about the way your mind is working. And we all have it and we all do it. But it doesn't say the mind will get all cleared up and you'll be fine. It would be nice. But it doesn't tell you that. It says the mind becomes no hindrance. It just doesn't be a bother. If we're depending on something besides our own bossy nature. And there's one extra wonderful addition. It says, if you do that, you're not afraid anymore. No fears exist. So as we sit, it's hoped that we, each of us, become more hopeless and more helpless. The first few days is a very ambitious kind of time and a very difficult time because one is sitting down with oneself. Oneself meaning one's mind and ambition and intention and all the things that we carry and call me. And it's not living up to our standards. It's not doing what we want it to. And so it's difficult and we hurt, our knees hurt and our shoulders hurt and we can't feel comfortable and we get tired out. And until we finally, one hopes, begin to feel a little helpless in the face of this mystery. That in the end, we can't do it. And we don't do it. Zen is a very strange practice because it's not a religion exactly. At least we're always told it's not a religion. And if it turns into a religion, it gets to be really, I would call, goopy. Just way too over the top with everything. You begin to explain everything with a religion and have reasons for everything, and it becomes very convoluted with many different energies at work and identified and blah, blah, blah. And some of it's very helpful. Some of it spells out how things exist of us. And yet if we take it all literally, we're just making up a whole nother story on top of the story. And it's a useless exercise. I mean, we can dress up and put on nice clothes like this and walk around and feel like you've got something. But really, you get nothing. This becomes extremely clear to me in my old age. And I hope you all live long enough to have this experience, because it just makes it so clear. In old age, you can't pretend anymore that you have something to say about how it's going to be. You can't pretend that you know what's going to happen next, or how you are going to comport yourself in the world. It's all one big surprise. But if you look at your life, already it's been one big surprise. The meaningful things that have happened to you have not been part of a plan that you made. They happen, and then you confirm it. Oh yes, this is what happened to me. This is my story. But I didn't make myself meet my husband. That, we could say, happened. But it happened like the leaves on the trees happen. The things that happen to us are normal and natural, and only ourself, because we identify ourselves with them. This is my story. This is mine. And the wonderful thing about having a Zazen practice is that we can see this. And we can see more deeply into the wonder it is to be alive. The incredible, amazing wonder that somehow all of this is. And we are. And the more in sync we are with things, the less ambitious we are, the more light we experience. Dogen said, the deeper the mud, the more Buddha. He also said, the four elements and the five skandhas are the Tathagata. It's not somebody or someplace else. There isn't anybody else, it's just us. Deep as the mud is, and that's incredible. So one of the things that people say about how to behave as a Buddhist, and this in the hippie days was sort of the bottom line, that you were spontaneous and you just did bam, whatever came up in your mind, and that's what Zen was. That Zen meant you just had all these incredible ideas and you just did them. Whatever it was, even if it was wild and crazy, that was Zen and that was the truth. But prajna is a different kind of informing of us. It too is information. And we all experience it. And I always think that if something comes up in my mind to do, especially about somebody else, even though I don't want to do it, and I don't think it's a real good idea because it's going to be some trouble, that the truth is right there, I should do it. I need to do it. And every time it's true. We all have that experience. We know what it is, but then we become the hindrance ourselves. We become the mind hindrance, having thoughts about it and resistance to it, and we don't do it. So developing a practice of paying attention to how our mind is working is the essence of Zazen. What's going on in here? Who is this? What is this? And in the end, we have to say, we don't know. We can name it, we can make stories about it, but the truth is, here we are, doing the best we can. When Koban was teaching the Bodhisattva vows, he rewrote them, and they go like this: sentient beings are numberless, they will enlighten themselves. Delusions are inexhaustible, they will end of themselves. I can't quite remember the Dharma gates part, but do you remember, Ryan?
Dharma gates, and so there is learning, right? Something like this.
Oh, and so there's wisdom.
Wisdom, learning, study, something like that.
Something like that, yes. And Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to allow it. I vow to allow it. Or accept it. So that's what I brought this afternoon. Are questions? Nico?
Thank you for that talk, Angie. It was really, it hit the spot for me at least. I'm probably not alone. Yeah, the Heart Sutra says, like, know this and know all these other things. It says, there are different translations, so I'm not exactly sure how to... But I think the version that you're using here this week says, no suffering, no cause, no cessation, and no path. That's more or less how it usually is. That always... That seems to me to be pointing directly to and referring directly to the Four Noble Truths. That there
it is the Four Noble Truths, yes.
Don't exist, or that stuff is not real, or there is a no in front of it, or surrounding it, or inside the center of it.
Yeah.
What does... I'd like to hear you discuss what that means. In terms of, like, if we're studying... the Four Noble Truths, which I know Thoring Zendo just did. Yet we start each session of that study with the denial of the object of the study. So, yeah.
That's how Zen is, right? It's perverse.
It's just Zen.
All of those are the original teachings of Buddha. The Four Noble Truths and the old age and death circle of life and stopping and etc. All of those things are the original teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, which become iconized. They become an icon. They become a fixed thing, as if they were real and solid. And then everybody has to believe them. And once you get into that mode of having to believe something, it's not true anymore. There's no air to breathe in it. So it's taking away that. It, by that time, it was the Dharma was about 1,000 years old, maybe 500 years old. And people had already begun to build on it and make more of it. And it just became more and more elaborated. And people threw their lives into it without actually having a sense of what it was trying to say. So much of the teachings, if you read the old koans, is just about another kind of no. You think it's something, but it isn't the something you think it is. It's already. Things are already. As soon as we're involved, it's already. Buddha is already. Truth is already. The truth isn't anywhere else. It's right here. That's why we need to be careful with our minds, very discerning with our minds, very insightful, and develop a really good practice. Yeah, it's a great question. Breathe.
This might actually dovetail somewhat with what Nico was saying, but I really appreciated how you brought up the no attainment. And I appreciate that so much because so much of this practice feels so masculine sometimes. Even the chants to me.
Yes.
I don't really feel a heart connection when I'm chanting the Heart Sutra. I feel like it feels like Japanese samurai, you know, and I just go along and, you know, watch whatever reactivity might show up and chant it. But I'm curious because it does seem, again, a little bit like ironic or paradoxical that there's this no attainment. Just connect with what's already there, and then there's practice like your hair's on fire. And
well, that's why we have introduced the Metta Sutta, because it brings a whole nother side into it, which seemed to me to be very, very necessary. That this is what should be studied as well. That this is at least as important as the, but it's the Heart Sutra is saying a real thing. It's just that it sounds so mysterious. Form doesn't differ from emptiness, and right away you don't know what emptiness is, and all of that. It just gets very confusing. And so it makes for great studies. People have written wonderful, fantastic, learned tomes about it. But it's very simple, really. And it's a condensation of many, many books of wisdom, all pointing to the same thing, all trying to say prajna, trying to say wisdom, and how to be wisdom, even as the five skandhas, even as things are. So you can't say, really, in the end, you can't entirely say.
Are there any chants or books of chants that were written by women?
Probably, but I don't know what they are. I don't know what Aoyama does with her nuns. We could find out. Coben said we should write our own chants. He said we should have our own precepts, our own chants, everything. So he always said it's all up to you. So he just brought what he was taught as a very tiny child. And that's what we inherited and have tried to develop in a way that works for some of us. And that's what Jikoji is. But this is just a beginning place. We don't know where it's going. So you're in a position to do something. Go for it, girl.
I was going to ask you to do that.
Oh, right. I'm an old woman.
And didn't you once give me, I'm sorry, a book about a nun that wrote hymns, a Buddhist nun? She was an organist. You gave me once a book.
Yes, yes.
Does that apply to what she's asking about?
I don't think so. It was, well, I don't know.
Was that more of a Christian thing?
Well, she was a Christian before she was a Buddhist, and she was an organist in a Christian church. So when she trained in Japan, as probably the first a Western woman, and I'm trying to think of her name, I always forget it. She thought everybody should, and they sang. They didn't chant at all, they sang the songs that she made for an organ in their temple. So that's a way, that's one way to do it. I'll think of it in a minute. But that's the only one I know, Western. You had something?
The Metta Sutta seems to me to add some yang to the yin of the Heart Sutra.
Yes.
Especially with lines like the ones that talk about, I'm kind of interpreting as properly nurturing a family, if you will, you know, great riches, you know, avoid the burden of great riches, and refers to looking at your family the same way, and the way a mother will protect her only child.
Yeah.
So yeah. It might be a little balance there, I guess.
Well, that's why we brought it in. It seemed very necessary.
Andy, when was that brought into the practice, or who wrote that?
Oh, we inherited that from long, long, long ago. I don't know how old it is. Maybe Carolyn knows.
It's there are different versions of that, so I'm not the particular one that we chant, and it's very similar to one that the Theravadins chant, but it's a little different. But it's very early.
Yes.
But even the Heart Sutra is very early.
Yes.
In the Satipatthana Sutta. It's like there's the fields of study, the mind, the body, the feelings, the mind. And then the Dharmas, where the Buddha says the same thing from the earliest texts. Nothing is worth clinging to. Forget about. Forget about enlightenment.
Yes. Stephen Batchelor, whom Carolyn knows, has written some books about this and given many talks all around the country, around the world. He goes way back to original teachings of Buddha and the earliest people who were expressing the Dharma and sort of bringing it back into focus in a different way. From, you know, it's gone through more than 2,000 years of many different kinds of things. Bodhidharma arriving from Sri Lanka and into China. And then in China it took off as a Taoist practice. And then they sort of merged with Taoism, Buddhism, with Bodhidharma's way of sitting Zazen. He brought sitting with him. And then it went to Korea and Vietnam and Laos and Japan, finally. And the Japanese took it, and they had already a naturalism kind of religion, a worship of nature. And they incorporated Buddhism into that. And then when the samurais developed, the warriors, they took on Zen because it gave them fearlessness, the same fearlessness that the Heart Sutra is talking about. You know, they go out and be ready to kill and be killed. And that became the model. And that's still in the Japanese model. If you go to Eiji, you see how they train the monks by beating them and driving them up and down the stairs and at all hours of the day and night. It's really just incredible. And not what we would think of as a Zen practice at all. So it has many, many permutations, many, many flavors. And we just got one from a young guy whose father was a Zen teacher, who was actually very brave and very kind and had his own temple and was training monks in Japan. And made sure his children learned how to sit Zazen at the age of 2. They learned full lotus at the age of 2. Because then the legs are very soft and you can just bend those bones any way you want. So, and then at the age of 6, he had an old nun teach him to memorize the whole of the Lotus Sutra, which is about this thick book. And he had his head shaved at the age of 12 and was teased in school, of course, and made fun of because he was turned into a little monk. So he said he was pickled in Zen. And he was not a Zen kind of person in that way at all. He was very different from that. Very soft and gentle and kind and quite original in his thinking, quite unusual. And everyone recognized it. Nobody knew what to do with him. His father died when he was 6. And he was adopted by a local monk whose temple needed someone to come after him. So Coben was supposed to inherit the temple when the old man died. And instead, Suzuki Roshi discovered him at Eiheiji. And he was pointed out as one of their best monks, and that's what Roshi needed, was the best monks to help him set up Tassajara. So Coben got this letter on his zafu at Rohatsu Sesshin one day and just thought he'd died and gone to heaven because he always wanted to come to the West. And he asked his old master, he said, I've got this invitation. I've always wanted to do this. And the master said, no way. So he asked him three times. And the old teacher said no three times. So Coben came anyway, which is about as big a no-no as you can commit. And so he had a very fraught relationship with his family because they were horrified and embarrassed. And the old man, of course, was very mad. And it was a mess for a long time. And finally, Coben's students started going to meet them. They wanted to meet the old master from Coben. And it began to join his chanting. He didn't do zazen, he did chanting in the early morning. And they would go and just sit close by and chant with him. And finally, the old man asked who the heck they were. And they explained. And little by little, the old man softened and relented. And then Coben showed up with a couple of his friends and a bottle of bourbon and just broke the whole thing down into a fine place again. So the old man adopted somebody else, and Coben liked that person. So that was all a happily ever after. And that's the story about that. David?
Back to Bree's point about I have the same trouble with maybe just this session, but in general with the translation that we use here. I learned a different one that was, to my ear, more poetic. And I stumble on this one. It brings thoughts up, and I become self-conscious and stuff, and trying to keep up with all the no's, for example. In the version I learned, there was an ellipsis in there leaving a lot of that stuff out. That in other ways, it was just a different poem. Mm. And so you might try, I don't know what the point is, except I wish I could chant my original version too. Because it was more heartful and more connected to just the old days, but no, I think to my
heart. Softer.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear it. If you could share it with me, or send it to me.
I'll send it to you. Yeah.
The one that we use was translated at Tassajara by Suzuki Roshi and Richard Baker and Coben. And it was sort of a last minute thing. And I don't know how careful they were with the translation. I know they knew they had to do it, and they did a lot of translation quickly in order to create this place that people were going to be coming to.
Excuse me, are you speaking of the Heart Sutra or the Metta Sutra now?
The Heart Sutra.
The Heart Sutra. So that's the version that's on the card that we use for Zendo.
Yes.
So who did that translation, please?
Suzuki Roshi. And Richard Baker, Roshi, and Coben.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And I took out the he's. As soon as I was, was that Chikoji. I took out the he's. The Bodhisattva he. There was another one in there too. So that was always very annoying. Yeah.
Thank you for taking out the he's. Thank you for that clarification on the translation. I love that translation. It is very imperfect, but for its imperfection, you have to almost retranslate it, like topsy-turvy views. It's so much more meaningful than perverted views or inverted views or however else it's expanded. The thing I wanted to say was in the Metta Sutta, it says, even as mother of the risk of her life watches over and protects her only child, I certainly understand the sense of that in terms of the degree of, you know, urgency and the, you know, the existential drama of that. But it also always strikes me as kind of sexist because it so closely associates the mother with the child-bearing function, which is the root of the oppression of women, I think, historically. So it always seems both positive in that, well, there is a female presence in the sutta, but those are so rare that to have one that so neatly reconfirms that role.
Domestic.
Well, it's that division of labor, which in a modern context is, you know, optional, certainly, and, you know.
Well, I think that's what the definition of mother is, having a child. And having been a mother three times, it's certainly accurate that there is this, you're really helpless in the face of it as a mother if your child needs something. I mean, I have one of my children who's still needing things, and although I resist trying to help him because I think he should help himself, in the end I always do it. I just can't help it. But I know what you mean. There could be more things in there, like that are less domestic.
It's not the domesticity that I see as being somewhat problematic. It's just the perpetuation of the essentialized role, which in a modern context is a very political thing and social thing.
And there are many, many fathers who have the same mind. Yes.
Put parent in them.
Well, I've always thought it might make sense to do something like even as parents at the risk of their lives, watch over and protect. I mean, you can parse that in any number of ways to broaden it. And
well, I think you guys should just get to work on all this stuff. Do something about it.
Yeah,
it's tricky. Thank you.
Dennis?
In that case, I second David's version.
You know David's version, too.
Yes.
Yeah, it's probably more Rinzai than it is Socho. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't see that theme in it, but it definitely half and half, for sure, coming out of my Zoomy version.
Yes, it has to be.
Yeah. It's briefer.
That's always a good thing.
And it's also a good thing to chant it with 30 disciplined monks in a monastery, or, you know, as close as you get to it in the old days in this country, where the resonance and the voice is in, there's no hesitation, there's no reading. That it's, I mean, you can literally get lifted off the floor chanting with your ears.
Yes, right.
But that was that.
Yeah, thank you. Paula? I just have to, you know, put my word in. Why? I've always thought that this is a work, as Coben said, that will take 500 years. I don't know why he gave it a specific time, but how could any of us have the audacity to say, okay, this is the way it's going to be? And so we'd have a committee. I can just see it. Oh, my God.
Yes, it would be that
Send
way.
Send it to the center
shoot. Yeah, right. Oh, and then I'd be an offshoot because they wouldn't agree.
They wouldn't agree. Yeah. Right.
Oh, well, oh, it would be awful.
A different language that we make up ourselves.
Yes. Just beautiful sounds. Emily?
Michael Newhall had a practice here studying the Heart Sutra, and I thought it would be a wonderful, occasion to sit. You know, we talked about Red Pine's version and Catherine Thanis. We discussed, with her and Red Pine, and had a whole workshop here. And it was like an argument session the whole weekend.
Yes.
It was really troubling because everyone was saying, no, it means this. And in the end, it seemed like for me, the best thing about the Heart Sutra, because I had been reciting it for so many years without even questioning what it was about, I didn't even think about it. It just was what I chanted and loved it and just absorbed it, and I felt it's magic. That's it. You don't have to understand it in terms of knowing exactly what it is, what they're saying, and it had that effect on me. And all the arguing was so unlike what I anticipated. But the good news is that they brought a bunch of CDs from all parts of the world of people who chant the Heart Sutra in different languages. And the one of my favorites was the Korean or Vietnamese chant, and she was beautiful. And it was all done to music, and it was the most feminine version, but I couldn't understand a word she was saying.
Yeah.
But it was still the most, and Michael Newhall probably has that. I have it, and I'm sure he has it too, and he has a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So it's worth, not giving up on that same version.
It's singing, isn't it?
Singing.
Yes, that's what Thich Nhat Hanh does too. Mm-hmm. They do it that way. On YouTube, you can get all of those. Well, we're way over time. I'm not a bit sorry.